It is the 75th commemoration of the invasion of Europe by the Allies on June 6th, 1944, World War II. And we're going to talk about it in a different way than you are likely to hear this week, and especially this weekend, in Podcast 838, the Bob Davis Podcasts. Well, this special 75th commemoration podcast is sponsored by Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul for home or business. And one of the things they want me to emphasize is quality service and replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems. So it is starting to get warm. If you haven't tested your air conditioning, it's a good idea to have it checked. Also, other things that people try to repair themselves, and it ends up costing them way more money. Maybe you own property and you're going over there every Saturday to try to fix things that are broken. And when it comes to plumbing, it's a good idea to know your limits, and that's why we call plumbers. Ryan Plumbing and Heating goes back four generations in St. Paul's Frogtown. To call them and get the quality service when you have plumbing or heating problems or air conditioning problems these days, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. They go metro-wide from St. Paul all over the place. When you have plumbing or heating problems, you want people, and air conditioning problems, I have to mention, you know, heating or air conditioning, same thing. It's air conditioning, whether it's heat or air conditioning. But you got to have people that know what they're doing, and that's what they're all about. Quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Metro-wide from St. Paul. Check them out online and give them a great review, ryanplumbing.com. So June 6th, 1944, the early morning hours, the 82nd and 101st Airborne Division and the British in those balsa wood gliders landed in Europe, and the invasion of France to push the Nazis out of France and push them back into Germany and defeat Hitler in World War II had begun. I have studied World War II since I was a kid. It was our father's war, my father's war, and my grandfather's war. And as kids, we played war. And when we got a little older, we kept playing war. We went to the Army Surplus Store in Hammond, Indiana, when we were in our, you know, Boy Scouts, 10, 11, 12, 13. We bought holsters and ammo belts and masks, tanker goggles, army boots, scarves. Somebody might have bought a helmet or a flashlight. Sometimes we could convince our dads to buy a pup tent or something. And it was always interesting to watch our dads pick through the stuff and kind of just be quiet. They didn't take as great an interest in chevrons and captain's bars and khaki shirts, moon boots, field jackets, and liners that were great for camping and pretending, Navy pea coats and so forth, as we did, because they had lived it. So in scouts, you know, a few of the dads were combat veterans. They didn't talk about it. My uncle was a combat veteran. He served in the Army Air Force as a tail and side gunner and finally a belly gunner. The belly gunner was the guy who wouldn't be able to get out if the gear on the plane failed, and a lot of times it did. It was a death seat. He never talked about it. He came home without a scratch, and my dad, who was a sergeant and a cook in the railroad terminals in England, was the one who got wounded in an air raid and came home with a Purple Heart. My uncle drank, and we heard the stories about my grandfather calling my dad up and say, in the middle of the night, time to go downtown and find Calvin Budd. He's on a bender. And we never understood, because we didn't understand war. 22 missions over Germany would drive anyone to drink, first in B-17s and then B-24s. You know, a few years ago, I had the opportunity to take a flight in a B-17G, which never saw action. It was built after the war or at the very end of the war. It never got over to Europe, and it was used as a forest fire plane, you know. And then it was restored to all of its B-17G glory, and the B-17s were very tight. So you had 9 to 11 crew members cramming themselves in there with those suits that they wore and oxygen hoses and everything else, especially towards the rear of the aircraft where the tail gunner was and where the two guys had the side machine guns. And the thing that you notice right away is you can almost put your finger right through the aluminum walls of that plane, literally. And so they're paper thin. And the thing I thought of just from my reading, standing in that plane and flying in that plane, was I can't imagine standing back to back with my brother there trying to shoot down a German fighter coming at us at closing speeds of around 700 plus miles an hour, pouring 20 millimeter shells in our direction. Now, these are white hot lead shells about the size of a Coke can that would cut a man in half. One hit would cut a man in half and tear the plane to pieces. I don't know how anybody survived that effort, let alone D-Day. When I was growing up, they showed movies like They Were Expendable or the original D-Day movie, The Longest Day, which premiered in 1960 in black and white. They showed that on the NBC Saturday Night Movie. PT-109, which detailed John F. Kennedy's story, John Wayne, Richard Widmark, 12 O'Clock High, guys like Jimmy Stewart and James Michener, or we watched the TV series Combat with Vic Morrow religiously, a black and white series that depicted a squad very much like Saving Private Ryan in black and white, and that ran for two or three years, never missed an episode. Or documentaries like The World at War, which was produced by the BBC, I think, and narrated by the great Richard Basehart. Everybody in this country, the United States, has a story. They may not know that they had an uncle with PTSD because they didn't call it then, or somebody who served in the airborne, or a grandfather who was a CB and built the airstrips in the Southern Pacific where the Enola Gay took off from. I grew up with my mom showing me pictures about my grandfather in the South Pacific. She used to have these things called acetates, which are recordings on disc that she actually recorded off the radio of the surrender of the Japanese in 1945 on board the USS Missouri. And lots of pictures, as I said, of my grandfather in khaki with four packs of Camels in his front pocket, tan and grinning. He had the time of his life. This is a guy who, by the time World War II rolled around, he had been in three wars. He was a master chief. He saw combat, deadly hand-to-hand combat in those islands, and he was probably in his late 40s, if not early 50s. He was there to build airstrips and to be the shore patrol to make sure that drunken Marines didn't steal stuff, not to fight hand-in-hand in the sugarcane, but that is what he did. He did his part. They all did their part. And I just want that to sink in, because no matter what those guys did, they all had a piece, and none of it could have been done if they had not worked as a team. There was no necessarily individuation, because you couldn't win that way. Everybody had a role to play, and they played the role selflessly, I think. And as I got older, I read everything I could get my hands on about World War II. The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, Kurahee, Thunderbolt, then larger books like Atkinson's Day of Battle, Weinberg's A World at Arms, Gregor Dalla's classic 1945, On Hitler's Mountain, books about Japan in the war, Russia in the war, China in the war, Fortress America, books on diplomacy of the war, the economics of the war, aircraft, guns, infantry weapons, rounds, loads, you know, all that stuff, because it's fascinating. And then a few years ago, I had the chance to go to Normandy. So the story is, and I've told it in other podcasts, my father-in-law, who had been a boy in the late 30s and 40s, and also idolized the older boys who had joined up, decided to take us all to France, all expenses paid, on a military tour of Normandy. And it was one of the best things. I'm so grateful that we got a chance to do that. All the men in the family from 10 to 80 got to go. And when you stand there and look up that hill at Dog Green, which was the beach where the most carnage occurred, two things strike you. First, it is amazingly small. It is a short distance from the beach to that hill where those very high rate of fire German machine guns were dug in, and where they just poured lead into these guys jumping out of these pitching LSTs in, you know, heavy clouds and pitching seas and everything else. And the second thing that struck me was that anyone made it out of that alive to begin with. And, you know, when that tour, we saw it all. We saw the guns at Point de Hoc, where Darby's Rangers climbed up the cliffs under fire, the first Ranger mission. And by the way, pointlessly, I might add, because the guns had already been destroyed by an air raid and essentially abandoned. But nobody knew that. The hedgerows, where many of the guys who made it up that hill on D-Day were later killed, where the 82nd and 101st Airborne parachuted early in the morning on June 6, 75 years ago, and also the British, you know, where they landed to take the bridges and Cherbourg and the whole, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Cacocton Peninsula. And I still felt like a boy reading a book or talking to an old guy about the war, because I never served. And as my dad said in, you know, the time that Vietnam was coming to a close and I was, you know, not quite old enough to be drafted and they still had a draft. And I remember him saying, boy, you better hope that you don't have to get drafted because you won't enjoy it. And I could do 200 podcasts about all the wonderful things I remember from my glorious studies of the war, the planes, Lend-Lease, the ships, the M1 Garand and the BAR. But that is what everybody will do. They will take those icons and they will talk about this history and they will glorify it. And it should be glorified. I'm not saying it shouldn't. But in the second half of this podcast, I'm going to talk about what World War II actually did, because I think that is probably the most significant takeaway from all of this, especially on the 75th anniversary. So one of the coolest things that I mentioned in this podcast, EAA, the air show at Oshkosh, always has a great show of all of these planes from World War II. They've got Corsairs, they've got Hellcats, they've got P-51s, they got P-47s, and they've got Sky Raiders, which was the last big prop, you know, attack aircraft, close-in attack aircraft that was built at the end of the war and used in Korea and Vietnam. I could go on and on. B-17s, B-24s, B-36s. They've got all kinds of current and classic aircraft at the air show. And if you're going over there, if you're a pilot, pilots fly in because they can camp next to their planes and have a great time and, you know, hang out with pilots and do all that. If you're a pilot and you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, especially in the pattern at EAA, you want the Alpha Systems Revolutionary Angle of Attack Indicator. Why is it revolutionary? It's not just hooked in to the plane's autopilot. You've got a visual display of how much lift your wing is producing so that on final turns or any kind of turn, whether it's takeoff or landing, you can keep that plane in the air, and that is so important. That is one of the primary causes of accidents in civil aviation. So visit EAA. Alpha Systems will be in Building 3, as they always are. They'll be six deep, as Mark Korn explains how it works. Check them out online at Alpha Systems. All you have to do is go to the BobDavisPodcast.com and click on the Alpha Systems banners for more info about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator. One of my best friends asked me the other day, you going to do a podcast about the 75th anniversary of D-Day? And it's an innocent question. And I was like, I don't know. I'm almost played out in terms of stuff to say about World War II. And I said I didn't think I was going to do one because I thought everybody is going to do one. And most of us who are still around, you know, most of us who are around, period, don't have a clue of what we're talking about because we didn't live then and we didn't experience it. And I'm going to explain why that's significant. And we are losing those people every day that lived during that period of time. And it was such a significant time. And then I thought, you know what? No, I know what I'm going to talk about, and I know why, because everybody else will be doing the whole thank you for your service thing, which, you know, yes, you should thank them for their service and for what they did, and you should remember those who did not come home. You know, World War II is a tremendous cost to this country, tremendous, you know, monetary debt, but a tremendous human cost. And, you know, on street corners and, you know, streets all over the country, there were many, many, many Gold Star windows where mothers put gold stars remembering their sons who did not come home. And they stayed in those windows for years. And that is the cost of war that people don't think about. Because when you watch all the propaganda films, including Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers, as good as they are, it makes it all look like a great adventure. And It's very interesting because as I've read many, 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 many books and talked to many people about it, I remember a soldier writing in his book about the war. He was in the 9th Division, I think, and they came in on D-Day plus 5 or 10 or maybe even 30, so 30 days after the invasion. And he said as he moved across Europe, in it to win it, so in it for the duration, I hardly ever saw an officer. I did not know where I was going, what I was doing. I only heard one shot fired and fired one shot during the entire war. So during that entire time, he only heard one report of gunfire and returned fire with his M1 during that period of time. He regularly went AWOL, as many of the others did in that division, holing up in some French or German town for a few days. And they would be rounded up by some sergeant, put on a truck, taken somewhere, get off the truck, walk for 3 or 4 days, rounded up again, put on a truck, and go somewhere else. Sometimes towns would be on fire. Sometimes they wouldn't see anything. And they had no idea where they were most of the time or even what they were doing. They didn't even really see any officers. But anyway, I think it's fair to say that there are probably three events in U.S. history that are really, really, really significant. And this gives short shrift to many things that were significant, whether it's the Mexican-American War or the Indian Wars or the settlement of California or what building the big cities or whatever you want to say. But when it comes to significant turning point events, there were really three events in our history as the United States that are important. The Revolutionary War period up to and including the ratification of the Constitution. The Civil War, because it changed federalism and created the United States. But the biggest and most significant event, I believe, in 200 years, and a lot of people are going to get on my case for saying this because I think it surpasses the Revolutionary War and even the Civil War, is World War II. Arguably, World War II, the most significant event in the last 200 years for the United States, not only for the United States, but also for the whole world. Well, why do you say that, Bob Davis? Because going back to the Depression in the U.S. and worldwide in the early 30s, governments and almost no one understood this was happening at the time, and it includes the U.S. government. Governments across the world started running amok, proving once again the highly pernicious and dangerous power of governments, elected or not. In our country, an economic depression caused not by a stock market crash, but by the reaction of incompetent central bankers and politicians kept making things worse. So bad that by 1939, the United States economy took a turn for the worse and recessed again. Meanwhile, the Depression created the conditions for fascism and nationalism to emerge and explode in Europe, first under Mussolini in the early 20s, who, by the way, started his career as a socialist, and later by Hitler, who was a third way, a middle way between the communists and socialists and the conservative Weimar Republic. On the right. And in Japan, same thing. Nationalist leaders in what was essentially a monarchy, invasions of China and the Spanish Civil War kind of kicked things off in the mid-30s. No one was paying any attention to that because of what was going on in our country and the rise of Hitler that many in our country thought signaled a tremendous bit of progress. Both the Soviet Union, with Stalin as well as Hitler, people thought was they had solved the economic problems that we were suffering through, and they weren't slouches. People like Henry Ford thought Hitler was great, and John F. Kennedy's father, old Joe Kennedy, thought that Hitler was great. In fact, that was the reason he was recalled as the ambassador to England. As the war, clouds gathered. And we all know the story, but most people don't know that almost a million people marched in New York and San Francisco and across the country in the summer of 1941 against involvement in overseas wars because we sensed that the cost was going to be very high. And I didn't mention World War I on purpose because World War I did not have the significance in terms of being a turning point that World War II had. At the time, Congress refused even to allow the U.S. to arm our future allies and refused to build up the military in the late 30s. President Roosevelt, for all the things that he did wrong, had to literally, twist arms to even get prepared for a war that he knew was coming. And we were terribly ill-prepared for World War II. We didn't know it was going to be World War II. We had no idea of the volume of planes and ships and ammunition and guns and tanks and trucks and rubber and everything else that we would have to produce, would have to be produced. No one in this country or the world had ever produced anything in the volume that would ultimately be needed anywhere in the world to fight World War II. So the industrial organization wasn't there. We had to invent it. I mentioned this just as an aside. At the time and throughout World War II, German uniforms were still handmade, and they had handmade wooden buttons, and their rations were very much the same types of rations that they had had in World War I. The much vaunted German Mauser infantry weapon, as good as it was and as good as their machine guns were, was, after all, a bolt-action rifle that had to be manually cocked and reloaded after each firing. Most people don't realize even the Blitzkrieg was pretty much troops on trucks and very small tanks that they had been allowed to have under the Versailles Treaty after World War I. So they didn't invade Poland in 1939 with Tiger tanks. They invaded Poland with horses and horses pulling cannon coming up behind trucks and very small tanks. And it was mostly intimidation. They invaded the Sudetenland with wooden guns, and no one knew. They painted them to look like real cannon. There had never been a successful invasion of Europe, really. Our invasion of Italy a couple of years before D-Day was a sordid affair consisting of incompetent mistakes, men drowning, getting killed on the beaches, unable to move inland, and finally getting bombed by their own heavy bombers. The weather was terrible on June 6th, and our invasion was almost held, in the peninsula there once the Germans rallied in the hedgerows. Throughout, whether it was the Battle of the Bulge or the butchery on Guadalcanal, Iwo, Okinawa, and 100 places that people have forgotten since, or the strains of yellow fever, which were developed and released by the Japanese in China, that still kills people in China. Biological warfare. The German heavy water and the buzz bombs and the V-1 and the fear that they would get an atomic bomb before we did, and our atomic bomb that ended it all. Until August 6th and August 9th, 1945, we, the people of the United States, and really the government of the United States, really didn't know if we were going to emerge as the winner in World War II or whether the world was going to hold together afterward. They really weren't sure what kind of world was going to exist after the war. We had to rebuild and rearm Europe. We had to create whole new currency regimes. We had to create a whole new banking structure. We had to figure out how to incorporate this terrible weapon called the atomic bomb and the subsequent H-bombs. We had to figure out how to contain the Russians and on and on and on. Think what it must have been like to have been 18 years old in 1940, having experienced the Depression and the hopelessness of the Depression and the crime, especially in the early 30s, to be drafted to or end up joining the Marines or the Army and survive combat, to come home after the war, to come home to a country that sat athwart the world, literally, as the victor just 5 years later. We blew up every factory in the world. We were the not only the forge of Fortress America and the forge of World War II, industrially speaking, but we had destroyed all of the other production capabilities. So the United States rapidly soared to the biggest economic power in the world. And, you know, I just think that must have been an incredible experience for those people to have known the world that you grew up in, which was obliterated. And in the United States' case, not destroyed in war like in Europe or the South Pacific, but destroyed by the war as a land that time forgot, because the United States of the 1920s and 30s, the United States post-World War I, and even the United States pre-World War I, existed until World War II. After that, everything changed. Within 5 years, jet power. Immediately in 1945, nuclear power. All sorts of abundance. Superhighways. Bretton Woods. The suburbs. The Cold War. And H-bombs. And suddenly the fear of a war that would kill everyone. And everywhere, growth and economic superiority, all of it non-existent just 5 years before. I've often told the story that if you go into a Dairy Queen, I don't know if they still have them or not, but there's a picture of a Dairy Queen somewhere in the United States, and you can tell that it is right after World War II because you can tell by the cars. And the people are all lined up at this Dairy Queen because there's a radio station remote because you can see the truck to try out the Dairy Queen that's just been built in their town. And then you look down at the sidewalks, which are cracked and broken and uneven, and your eyes raise up to the people who are wonderfully enjoying their ice cream on a hot summer day somewhere in America, obviously someplace in the East or Midwest. And they are thin as rails. All of them are thin as rails. Their clothes are hanging off them. Their suits are hanging off them. Their clothes are hanging off them because we starved ourselves. Everybody starved themselves from the Depression through 4 years of World War II. And this is why it is such a significant event in our history. Again, from nothing, from all really failing, the country failing, to jet power, nuclear power, you know, trains that carry a horn of plenty of goods throughout the country, building skyscrapers, IBM, the Bell system, you know, long distance calls, radio and television, all of that exploding onto the landscape, and responsibility for the rest of the world suddenly, for the banking system, for making sure that we don't have another war, for holding the Soviets at bay, and on and on and on. A completely different world in just 5 years. And for the last 70 years, we have enjoyed the peace and security their sacrifice brought us. That is the significance of World War II, as well as the sacrifice of all those who fought the Cold War just after World War II, and the sacrifice of the people that lived through the Depression and ate onion sandwiches every day or beans every day for 10 years. It's interesting because the thing is, we today do not have the black and white clarity that World War II, gave people at the very end, the closure that it gave people, despite the bomb. I'm not sure that just a few short years after that, 2 or 3 years after World War II, that clarity still existed. World War II is certainly those veterans who look out on the graveyards with young eyes, even though they are in their 90s and dying out every day, or the restored B-17s and, Vought Corsairs that you see at the air shows, or the Jeep or tank guy down the street that restored these World War II vehicles like the tank or the Jeep, like I said, armored cars and so forth, or, you know, being able to buy a BAR or a Tommy gun or, a 1911 pistol or something to that effect. But nothing like World War II has happened since, even though we have had some pretty amazing things that we've had to live through. It happened, World War II, again, not because we weren't patriotic or were patriotic, but because governments all over the world failed us, including our own, and it's something we should never, ever forget, and this is something no one will talk about on this weekend because we are going to celebrate the glory of what these people did, because for many of them, it will be the last remembrance of that period of time that they will have. And I treat it with a great deal of reverence as the turning point in U.S. history. It is the event that made this a great country. And that is the lesson that we should take from all this, is that they created this huge problem that nearly destroyed us, literally, because if the Japanese had had nuclear weapons, they certainly had the delivery systems. They bombed us in World War II, not just in Hawaii, but on the mainland. They tried to bomb us. They also tried to use biological weapons against us. And of course, the Germans had the delivery systems with the V-1s to at least use a nuclear weapon on England or get a nuclear weapon to the United States. So we survived that war and became victors, literally by the skin of our teeth and the teamwork of an entire generation of people that is now canonized as the greatest generation. And we shouldn't forget them, and we should always thank them for what they did. But I think it's really important to point out that a lot of this happened because of the idiots running our governments. I'm sorry. And many of them are heroes today, regarded as heroes, and maybe they are. But much of what happened and much of the cause of World War II was self-inflicted, and certainly the depression in the United States was self-inflicted as well. That's controversial, but I think it's something to think about while you're watching all sorts of propaganda about World War II and the obvious corollaries between the greatest generation and the fight that we're fighting and all this other nonsense that that we're putting up with. This was a war that killed hundreds of thousands of people from the United States, and millions of people worldwide. 31 million Russians and Ukrainians were killed in that war, not to mention 6 million Jews, not to mention millions and millions of Germans. Germany was never the same, is not the same as well, and England never recovered from World War II. And one could argue that France never recovered from World War II. The Europe still struggles because of what happened. It is a calamity that to a certain degree was self-inflicted. And, you know, a short podcast is not enough time to detail how much the world physically changed and how the world was physically brought together and at the same time torn apart, whether it is in the Middle East with the emergence of the State of Israel after the war, or Northern Africa with Egypt and Tunisia and Libya and the development of oil resources in Saudi Arabia and all through that area, Burma and that whole area between India and China and Southeast Asia and the Aleutians and the Pacific Rim and all those countries that before really nobody paid attention to. You had to take a clipper, you know, the Pan Am clipper to get there today. And right after the war, you could fly DC-4s and, you know, Constellations and later jets to those areas very easily. So the world was completely different. As primarily as a result of this conflict. It moved us forward very quickly, even though it was a calamity. Thanks once again to Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul for sponsoring this special D-Day commemoration podcast, the Bob Davis Podcast. Remember, when you have plumbing or heating problems or air conditioning problems in the summer, you have to have people that know what they're doing, and that is Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul. You call 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488, online at ryanplumbing.com. Thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcasts on iTunes, off the page at thebobdavispodcast.com, streaming audio, as well as clicking on a podcast and actually hitting play. I do post these on Facebook, and I appreciate it when you see that on your page, if it shows up in your feed, sharing a podcast post so that other people know it's there. And favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter always helps, of course, and for your donations at thebobdavispodcast.com for mobile podcast command. And I'm heading out pretty soon. I'm not going to say where I'm going yet because some people might hear it that shouldn't hear it yet. And stay tuned, but the donations go right into the tank. Thank you, Ed Nass, for a donation just recently at thebobdavispodcast.com. So you look for the picture of Mobile Podcast Command, which is the ambulance, and then you look for that yellow oval donate button. Click on that, and if you want to make a donation, PayPal takes it, and they take it from there. And I do appreciate the donations. I'll find out about it as soon as it comes through. Thanks for listening to Podcast 838, D-Day, 75 years on the Bob Davis Podcasts. And I'm going to close with just a quick mention that if you ever do get to go to Normandy, and you go there, you have to tour the cemetery, which is just above those beaches, because it is an extremely powerful experience, especially the chapel, which talks about a nation that did not come to conquer Europe, but to free it. And it is a really moving experience when you see how many people were sacrificed for that purpose. So this one is for those guys laying in those graves in Europe and the graves in the South Pacific, and for the families that they left behind.
Gonna take a sentimental journey, gonna set my heart at ease, gonna make a sentimental journey to renew old memories. I've got my bag, got my reservation, spend each dime I could afford. I'm like a child in wild anticipation, I long to hear that all aboard. Say